And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist and professor. He was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, and he teaches at the University of California in Berkeley and at Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memos and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
And do you see any recent historical examples of U.S. intervention that the U.S. could learn from, either in deciding not the decision will be made by Obama, but might well be made by the House, that we won't intervene? But on the other hand, if we do, is there any learning? I mean, it seems to me that everybody's paralyzed by what Bush, Cheney, and Rice and Rumsfeld did in Iraq. And that really is ruling the attitude of the American people, which in turn obviously is affecting the Congress, who supposedly represent them.
Well, I think it's absolutely true that history is haunting us. There's no question about it. And, you know, it's hard to think, not to think about the run-up to the Iraq War in late 2002, early 2003, when you hear about the claims of the chemical attack, the Congress demanding more information, people telling us that they have the information, but it can't be made public, etc. So that looms around us, and it's one of the great ironies that the current president, Barack Obama, was elected in saying his most famous line, which is he isn't against all wars, he's just against dumb wars. And he was talking about Iraq at the time, of course. When you ask about historical parallels, I think it's a complicated question, of course. The one I tend to think of, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but is Bosnia, is the war in the Balkans. The lesson I guess I would draw from that in retrospect, I mean, I covered it at the time, and there was a great genocide going on that probably killed 250,000 people. The U.S. essentially watched from overhead with its F-16s and F-15s. NATO had peacekeepers there but didn't intervene militarily. But finally, in 1995, the Clinton administration did launch a large-scale bombing campaign against the Serbs. And that, along with, and I think this is the critical parallel, along with a Croatian offensive on the ground that kicked the Serbs out of the Krajina, that did eventually lead to a diplomatic solution. And so I guess if one wants to look at recent history, one lesson to draw is that interventions are successful when they're not simply undertaken for humanitarian reasons, but they have a realist component as well that actually will lead plausibly to some ending of hostilities. Now, as I say, I'm surprised to hear myself saying this because at the time, I was outraged, really increasingly so, covering the war, that the U.S. and the West weren't helping defend Bosnian civilians and were sort of standing by where this massive killing took place. But in retrospect, you can see that the U.S. essentially waited until there was, in essence, a military component and a solution that could be seen on the ground that was absolutely imperfect. That is, it wasn't a just solution by any means, but it did bring peace. It did bring the end of the killing. I think this was about as imperfect an intervention as one could imagine, except for the current one, in which it seems to me when we're talking about Syria, we're talking about a very limited strike that would punish the Syrians and the Bashar al-Assad regime for stepping over a red line, violating a norm that is using chemical weapons. And there appears to be no component part of this idea that would lead to actually ending the conflict. On the contrary, it seems to me plausible that this U.S. intervention might make the conflict worse. So while everything in my bones says, you know, the U.S. should do something when you have a killing of 1,400 people using chemical weapons, I'm quite unpersuaded by the kind of ad hoc nature of what the administration has proposed. It doesn't sound to me like it's very well thought out or that it will go anywhere toward actually ending the killing.
But Mark Danner, perhaps the reason it seems sort of inadequate and symbolic is that they don't want to say what the perhaps the real intention would be, which is what I was discussing earlier, which is regime decapitation. Most of the guests that I've talked to said that that's likely what the strategy will be, to try and get rid of this mafia family and hope that the country can hold together afterwards. But most – the two people I talked about this earlier in the program thought that things were too far gone, which goes back to the U.S.'s feckless response to the rebellion when it first started and the overconfidence of people like Hillary Clinton, who thought it would be all over and Assad would fall. Obviously, they miscalculated, and they could have maybe done something then before the Saudis brought their al-Nusra people in, who now have poisoned the well and are playing right into Assad's hands.
Well, those two points are actually quite related, the one about regime decapitation and the surprising length of the war. I mean, I agree with you that there may be ideas within the U.S. national security bureaucracy that a strike might, if precisely targeted, actually have a very large follow-on effect on the regime itself, particularly if you killed members of the Assad family. People may be thinking that, but I'd remind listeners that that's exactly the way the Iraq War began, with an attempt to kill Saddam Hussein at Dora Farms. And, you know, these things are not – regimes like this, it is not very easy – to quote-unquote decapitate them. The other problem, of course, is it's not simply the Assad family. We have a very large national security bureaucracy there consisting of, you know, the 4th Armored Division, military intelligence, civilian intelligence. It's a very complex, interlocking security regime that vaguely resembles Saddam's regime as well. I mean, they both come from similar ideologies about 4 or 5 decades ago. And I'm unconvinced that simply killing or decapitating the regime at this point would bring an end to the war. It might make it easier, or it might make things much more chaotic. I think it is true that people in the U.S. government, as you said, including Hillary Clinton and others, underestimated how difficult it would be for a rebellion that started in the streets of Dara in the south actually to take over the country. I mean, in part, this has to do with the particular sectarian makeup of Syria and the fact that you have a minority regime that itself is supported by other minorities. You know, you have the Alawi, and then you have the Christians as well that back it. You also have the business class, which seems to have stayed fairly strongly, the large business class fairly strongly behind the regime, and the military, which, though there have been a lot of defections, the core of the military, the Alawi officer class, seems to have remained firmly, so far as we can tell, pretty firmly behind the Assad regime. So I guess I'm unconvinced that simply lobbing a few cruise missiles, if you kill the right people, would actually end the war or lead to a diplomatic solution. To me, this doesn't seem like a strategy. It may be what is being thought in the White House and the Pentagon, although I kind of doubt it. I think that they're probably pretty skeptical about that plan of events as well.
And meanwhile, you've got the Obama haters on the right in the Congress who will vote just to spite him because they hate him so much, because his credibility is on the line and he'll be a lame duck if they vote him down. And then on the left, you've got a lot of people, in spite of the fact that this rebellion started in the working class neighborhoods of Dara, you just mentioned, and the poor suburbs of Damascus, the left, at least elements of the left, seem to be in this country and abroad, seem to be bending over backwards to make excuses for this dictator. I don't understand that. I don't understand why people, the left used to be the champions of, railing against, quite rightly, U.S. hypocrisy during the Cold War of supporting the Marcoses and the Somozas and the Shah dictatorships. And nowadays they seem to be all in favor of this guy, and they're even suggesting that, I mean, friends of mine like Ray McGovern and Larry Wilkerson are now talking about that maybe this chemical weapons attack was a false flag Israeli operation, or that somehow the U.S. will shoot down or blow up one of its own destroyers to embroil us deeper into this war. I mean, what's going on with the, why are people going so far into this kind of weird speculation to make excuses for Assad?
Well, I think there's a lot of distrust. I mean, I think the first point that should be made is the case for these strikes is unpopular in the country, so far as we know. The president has not made his case publicly that this is necessary to a public that is very weary, not only of war, but of being lied to. And I think that's a, you know, extremely important point to make, that this is happening under the shadow of 9/11 and of the wars that followed it, particularly Iraq, but also Afghanistan, in which I think the public became very wearied of war and also weary of the feeling that it was being manipulated. So I think there's a lot, there's a lack of trust that's very important on the part of the general public. I think you're quite right about the right wing in Congress. They'll do anything to oppose Barack Obama. But again, to be fair, I don't think the president has made his case very convincingly of what exactly this will be. He's in this odd position of demanding a strike, but also having to emphasize at the same time that this will not be Iraq, this will not be Afghanistan, this will not lead to a wider war. And that argument is not terribly convincing because he doesn't say what exactly it will lead to in a convincing way. And finally, your point about the left. I think, you know, there is a broad segment of the political culture that we could call the anti-war left that simply does not want to see another attack and another war, and that's distrustful of what has happened to the United States since 9/11, the vast spending on national security, the expansion of just not just military, but surveillance and other things, the use of torture, the maintenance of Guantanamo, all of these things fit together. And I think that what you identify as members of the left that have gone so far as to, in a sense, seem to support the Assad regime or defend it, I think this is, at least my perception is, this is a fairly limited part of the left. Those who are talking about the chemical attack possibly being a false flag operation and so on, I think that reflects to some degree the fact the administration hasn't made publicly its case. It hasn't showed its evidence that proves that this attack did come from the Assad regime. Normally, of course, they might be able to count on on their own credibility and saying, you know, trust us. But we are in the shadow here, the dense shadow of the run-up to the Iraq war, in which we were told again and again, trust us. And the not only was the evidence faulty, but we were able to disprove it on the ground, which is a very unusual case. So I guess I tend to think, you know, to me, the broader point here is I am somewhat amazed that the Obama administration decided at this, in this kind of ad hoc, rather abrupt way, to go to Congress for approval, because it looks to me, at least from what I have observed, that it's very likely the House will vote this resolution down. It's possible he'll get an approval from the Senate very narrowly, and he'll be voted down in the House. And I'm not sure what that means. You know, you go to the Congress to try to get public backing, as it were, so you're not alone politically. If the consequences of this attack lead to something else, and the involvement becomes much deeper, but what does it say if you fail to get approval? I mean, it's kind of an unprecedented situation, I think, and it seems very, very badly thought out, very abrupt, very ad hoc. And I think, by the way, part of the distrust of Obama, particularly in the House and among Republicans, is this notion that he basically doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, I'm afraid that you're ending on a note there that certainly seems to be the what's happening at the moment. And Mark Danner, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, and professor, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, assistant producer Michael Schertzer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.